Ruud Elmendorp is a journalist that I've known about for 15 years at least, from the days of video blogging, when people who made video of where they were, of so many different subjects, independently using their own websites. And there was Ruud in East Africa, chiming in, sending messages, putting up video. And so it's like someone that I've known for a long time, yet at the same time, we've never met, despite the fact that even over the last few years, I go to East Africa for work regularly. I still have not met Ruud Elmendorp in person, so I'm really excited that now, in this time of the global pandemic, I have a chance to speak with him. So anyway, to the audience out there, today we're speaking with Ruud Elmendorp, video journalist in East Africa. He's on the line right now, just over breakfast in Tanzania. Hi, Ruud.
Good morning. How are you?
Pretty good. Here we are in, at least for the Netherlands, month number 3 of what we call COVID times, pandemic times. And there you are. In Tanzania, I mean, how do things look where you're sitting?
Well, it's very double. Mm-hmm. You can say I'm staying in paradise, but the downturn of it is that I'm stuck in paradise because there's no way to go. I came here, I think, 2 months ago when I was on assignment. And that was exactly when Tanzania reported its first COVID-19 case, which resulted in the border closure on all sides. So there I was in Tanzania, suddenly realizing I couldn't go anywhere.
Yes. And I mean, over the last few months, what have you been focusing on? I mean, you're a video journalist, so it's always been stories. That's how I know you. Stories about people, stories about what's happening in not just East Africa, but all over the continent and beyond. But what had your focus been just before this crisis broke out?
Just before it broke out, it was about corona crisis, that it was coming up. So 2.5 months ago, I did stories on the economic effects of the coronavirus, because already business was going down because the exports from China had stopped. So in Kenya, you could see that there were no mobile phones anymore for sale and other Chinese products. So already the crisis was coming up, also in terms of cosmetics and hair weaves. And then also suddenly we realized how much was coming from China, because we already knew it was a lot, but we couldn't see the whole thing. And it was much more than only mobile phones.
Yeah. It's always something that people talk about, but we rarely feel it completely. Even if you are in East Africa, as I go quite often these years, it's the relationship between China and Africa, and as you said, the amount of dependency, or at least the amount of things. So I find it very interesting that, for example, the idea of not being able to find technology and beyond. So now, in the current situation, what are you focusing more on? I mean, you can continue to do corona stories, I think, but what's the situation for you?
Well, I stay here on the beach with my good friends, yeah, in Mikadi Beach Club. But so I'm somehow limited, because the Tanzania government is not really open about the number of infections in the country. They only report once in a week. And so technically we have no idea of what's really happening outside here, because there are many viral videos going around with people lying dead on the street. And there are rumors about secret burials at night of COVID fatalities. So moving around here is a bit, I don't know, it carries some kind of danger you cannot oversee. And then secondly, Tanzania is not really friendly toward foreign journalists. So I'm in the process of getting my press accreditation, but that has been going on for 2 weeks now, and I didn't hear no, but I certainly did not hear yes. So it's a kind of double situation. But I'm getting small new businesses, and and I'm looking at ways to do work from here, that people give me stuff to edit or production work or whatever. And until the crisis, how you say that, until it stopped, yeah. And then I can move on with my business as I was doing it.
Yeah. Yeah, Ruud, just to go a little bit back in your career, in your life, you've lived in East Africa, I want to say for close to 20 years, but I might be overstating it. How long have you been in that region?
That depends on how you look at it. I came in 2001 to South Sudan. So first I lived in South Sudan, and that was during the war. So I had a quite exciting time, in fact, of living in the war zone, because that comes with special circumstances and certain kind of stress, but also a certain kind of joy. And when I came back to Netherlands, that was exactly what I was missing. So then I came back to Kenya, because I had some friends there, and that was in 2002. So yeah, 20 years is a good estimation.
Yeah. And what I remember, because in a lot of these interviews I've been doing, speaking with friends all over the world during this time, we always talk about how we know each other. And what I remember is in the days of video blogging, or what we called video blogging, which now has taken on a new meaning, here in Europe, we were gathering whoever, and it was beyond any borders or any continent, but we were looking for people making video and especially doing stories about everyday life. We thought that was really going to be the future. It should be the future, because we wanted to hear from people. And there you were already posting video on daily life, but not just that, on economics, on anything that affected humans. And that's how I remember knowing, not that we knew each other as friends, but we knew about each other. But what do you remember from those days of video blogging and video online?
Oh, yeah, you know, it's I started this in 2000. You know, I believe every business starts with a vision. And in 2000, the cheap digital cameras entered the market. So for 2,000 euros, you could buy a professional camera that before that time were more like 150,000 euro. So suddenly there was the opportunity to take on the filming myself. And indeed, I started hosting it on my website, which I had registered in the same time. And so I felt like being a pioneer.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look back, and you look to the future, you see that everybody started doing that, and also the bigger international channels. So, in fact, I created my own competition by being the first one doing that, and then later on see that the big boys who I was fighting against started doing themselves. But that's okay, because they're also among my clients now, but it's an interesting development.
Yes. Yeah, it is odd. Sometimes when we talk, those of us who used to do more video online and that now probably have stopped or are doing something else, we always talk about how nice it was back then. I guess that's sometimes a human tendency to look back and say, the good old days. But how nice it was in a time where there weren't so many people, or it wasn't so popular. As you said, the big guys hadn't yet come. But you sound like you don't see the developments of the last 10 or so years of video online as anything negative. You sound like you see it as an opportunity.
Certainly, because the technological developments continued, because I engaged into drone flying, which is a completely not a type of sport, because suddenly you have a camera who moves up and down in altitude, moves up and down, forward and backward, and you can turn the camera itself. So it's a total new dimension. And then there are gimbals, there are GoPros, there are all kinds of devices, mobile phones that film. So now as you're walking around with a multi-camera set, and then the challenge is to bring that together in one narrative. And I find that very interesting. And I'm also using my pioneership in that. You know, I did it before, and I'm going to do it again.
Uh-huh.
That's how I look at those things. And the stories remain the same. it's still about daily life, how people are surviving under difficult circumstances. And yeah, if you compare that to Western lives, who can be very rich in material circumstances, but maybe mentally a little bit poor, I don't know. But those are the things I'm looking at. And that if you have all those gadgets, then you can create a very big emotional response, because yeah, you have so many ways to tell your story. And happily, I'm from the days that we used to have control about what we're doing. You know, it was like writing with a typewriter. You couldn't make mistakes because the letter was there and it couldn't be deleted. So you have to know what you're doing. So I'm happy to have that background.
By the way, it's interesting. I hear in the background a very familiar sound of crows. And I know always when I sit in a nice cafe or lodge in, I don't know, Uganda, there's always the sound of crows in the background. So I hear in Tanzania, it's the same.
Yeah, yeah. They're horrible, but they sound nice, yeah.
Well, there's something so familiar. What is that?
Yeah, yeah. And then those ibises also, though, but I didn't hear so many ibises here, but also they're there.
But it's interesting. You also mentioned something that I've tried to understand and help with. I'm talking about the way video and photos, because of mobile phones and the capacity they have, the way false or half-truth type pictures, video get circulated. I know among my friends in East Africa, it's a thing. Someone will, if you're in a WhatsApp group, someone will send a photo and say, look what happened. And then it gets distributed and the story itself gets changed. But it's become such a common way that information travels. I mean, I'm sure you see a lot of examples of it. It almost becomes normal all over the world. But my experience has been in East Africa, where it's just the way video stories travel is oftentimes very, well, not very reliable. And it concerns me more in a time like this.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm getting many of those and I'm not distributing them because I don't know where it's going. And but I look at them to see if I can verify them. And then, so you have to look for small things that are indication of time or indication of period. And then suddenly you can see that particular film was from 1 year ago or from another completely other country. So you have to be very careful with that. It's even with those small films about deaf people lying on the streets of Dar es Salaam. Yeah. You know, it's very hard to verify whether that's true. You know, you have to listen to the voices and see whether people are wearing face masks and yeah, but it looked quite genuine, I have to say.
What does the lockdown officially, because there's also the unofficial stuff, but officially, where you are at least, what does the lockdown involve? Like what is allowed, what is not allowed?
Yeah, they have let's say it's the Tanzanian way of an intelligent lockdown. So they have forbidden public gatherings. It's compulsory to wear face masks in the city center. They reduced the number of people in public service vehicles. But outside town, these regulations are not there. So there you'll see that the bars are still open, restaurants, and that people gather in churches and they sing without face masks. And that's something very scary because it's allowed.
Yeah. The numbers, as you, I mean, you mentioned the reporting, the way numbers are reported is part of what makes the real information hard to get. What do you gather from your, I mean, you're not a doctor, I understand that, so I don't want to put you in that position. But at the same time, I watch the information coming from different countries in East Africa. I communicate a lot, for example, with friends in Rwanda, in Uganda, and the actual COVID cases are relatively low compared to the rest of the world. Of course, the deaths also low. But what are you, I mean, do you make any conclusions in your head at this point about how this is going to go?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I'm looking at the number of tests that are done every day. And that's around 1,000 maybe or less. And then they will get like 50, 15 cases, 1-5, or 20. But if I look at Djibouti, then they get a much higher number from the same 1,000 tests. It can be 160, 200, 350. So I'm not sure what's really happening. It's either that they're not testing adequately, or that the tests are not okay, or that the infection rate is low for some reason. And that reason is not really clear. Nobody knows. Because if you look at African societies, they're always very close to each other. They touch each other. They kiss each other. So the opportunity for transmission is there, but somehow they're keeping it low, or everybody's not telling the truth. But that, I don't believe that.
No.
I think they're just giving the real numbers. But I know that there's something going on which is not clear.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes me curious where else you can look. Like, so if there's not enough people getting tests, so if there's no test, you don't have any information about, you know, if does a person have this or not. So that's not going to be a COVID case. That's not going to be a COVID death. But then it does make me curious about other kinds of sicknesses and what's going on in hospitals.
Yeah, yeah. That's why I find in Djibouti, they do the same number of tests, 1,000 per day. But there they pick like 150 cases easily from the same number. So either they're tests are better or the number is higher. So it's weird because Djibouti is not so far from Kenya. It's in the same region. It's also on the ocean. And there are a lot of expats as well. There are Chinese, you know, so it should be a little bit more the same. So I don't know what it is. Maybe they're better connected to the outside world, or they had their first infection earlier on. And even what I see, even the health scientists, they also don't know what's going on. So it's interesting.
Hmm. It's also, I mean, I wonder what happens, you know, is this just a brief moment in global history? Is this, as some people say, a permanent change to how things work? Over here in Amsterdam, I tell you, it feels like this is not a permanent change. There's this desire to go back to exactly how things were, which I'm not sure if that's a good or a bad thing, but it's a thing. So in East Africa, I know there exists a high level of cooperation on some matters, the East Africa community. But times like this make it seem like countries are, okay, they close the border, they're sort of everyone's back on their own. But that's the feeling I get from out here. What do you gather? Is cooperation down? Is it reduced? And is it going to stay that way? Or what do you think this is?
That's a good question. I can see that the African Union gives regular reports and communicates about what's happening. But I don't see so many collaborations, only that they're maybe offering each other help with sending doctors or sharing medical supplies and sharing information. But I think you're right, yeah, that people are on their own. But the trade continues, that they didn't close the border for trade. So the transports are still ongoing. There are cargo flights are continuing under strict regulations. So the machine is running. It's only the informal sector that gets hit, because they used to be on the street with all their small businesses, and many of them are not allowed to do that anymore, so they're out of business as well. So and that's it. And in terms of change, yeah, I'm not so sure how they're going to change after this, because they first have to recover and then look at change. So because that's also what I see everywhere, that they're making the COVID crisis much bigger than it is, because so far I see it as a health crisis, that societies were not prepared for a pandemic, but they make it an environmental crisis, they make it a political crisis, they make it an urban crisis, that it gets blown out of proportion in my view, but that's just my view on it.
I I tell you, it's in, and I've been doing these interviews over the last few weeks, and I speak to people, for example, in cities like Mexico City and LA, and when you hear about how city life is now, that's where you hear people say, wow, this environment, I mean, at least in terms of the air quality, I like this. We didn't know we could do this.
I know. I read that in Venice, they can see the fishes swimming in again in the water, which used to be brown.
Yeah, and will be again, I guess. That's what I keep wondering.
I don't know. For myself personally, I've been here on the beach now for 6 to 7 weeks, and it's very clear to me that once this crisis is over, I'll go back into the life I had, because I liked traveling, I liked meeting people, I liked staying in hotels. So, and that's only me, so I can imagine that more people want to go back to the life they had.
Yeah. Yeah. And then when you consider you started by speaking about this, which is really interesting, the relationship between, for example, China and say a Tanzania or Kenya. I mean, we know it's a strong relationship. We know not just in terms of trade, but also the development, right? I want to call them mega projects. And I don't see those projects stopping. Although I think it's interesting that people can look around at this moment and go, oh, wait a minute, we don't have this, or we're not doing this because that was coming from China. And right now China's not engaging, or reduced engagement. So now what? What do we do? Oh, in this case, we wait. But of course, there have been people in the past in East Africa who say we should do it ourselves, or we should try to develop that capacity somehow. And I've seen those projects occasionally turn up. Some of them last, many of them don't.
Yeah, no, it's true. There might be a reconsideration that I can see, that suddenly people realize how dependent they were on China. So that one I can see. Then maybe they start importing from other sources as well. Because if you're going to get steel, you can also get that from India, I believe. So maybe that I can see. But the thing itself, I don't see it changing. That they will continue with big infrastructural projects because they need them. But already, when I did my stories, just before the crisis, the markets were already moving to other sources. Like I said, India to get raw materials, because that's the same route. So it's easy to divert the shipping routes to there. And yeah, maybe we'll see some more of that. And maybe what that would make Mr. Trump very happy, to have some more imports from the United States. I don't know. There are options available.
Yeah. Yeah. So if, I mean, you're waiting on a journalist visa, which, as you said, is taking way longer than it should, partially maybe because of the crisis, who knows. But if you do get your visa, where, as much as you're allowed to, without revealing your ways of working, but where do you want to be right now, and who do you want to be talking to if you were able?
No, I want to do a story about tourism. Mm-hmm. So I could do a story about how lodge owners are surviving during these days. And then there's a shipyard next to where I'm staying, and the shipyard is continuing production during the corona, and they have taken their measures to keep things running. So there's a nice story in there. And for the rest, I'll have to see. It will be corona stories, and especially Tanzania. I think they would appreciate some positive covering, because their president is not really helpful in giving positive messages with all those funny things he's saying. But so I could do stories about how the small traders are dealing with the situation. How do they solve it? Do they do business from their homes, or what other ways did they find? Because also what we have to understand, that the coronavirus for the average African, the average Tanzanian, is just one. Uh-huh. The many problems already there. So it's not having something new, they're just having something on top. Yeah. So they might be very creative finding solutions.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, they had Ebola, they had HIV, they had cholera, they had, you can continue.
Sure.
And this is just one of them.
Yeah.
And also, that's why I think why many Tanzanians are also not taking it very seriously, because they had so many other troubles before, and they'll survive this one also.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember, I think in February, I flew through Kenya, and there was a extra health check. And I thought, oh, this must be corona related. And when you look at the forms and all the questions, it's all Ebola, actually. And
Ebola, so they were ready. So that's another thought I had. Well, why the number of infections is low? Because the detection systems were already there. They were already picking people from the line that had fever. And I don't know what they do with them. And they were already aware. So that might have stopped things at the early stage.
Yeah. Yeah, there's an interesting thing where a virus, when you talk about populations and some kind of infrastructure that is very familiar with, like an Ebola, the possibility that there's a virus coming maybe through tourism or travel or some other means, and they're already trying to detect it before it even becomes a major issue.
Yeah. Ethiopia is the same. They also have these temperature guns. But even South Africa, that amazes me because they already had an Ebola awareness, but somehow there it slipped through.
Mm, yes. And in the meantime, there you are on a beach among some friends, thankfully. What do you find yourself, you know, I find myself taking up hobbies that I didn't have before, whether it's music or learning something. What do you find yourself learning or spending more time doing these days?
Now, basically, it's quite the same. Just that I'm doing more, I have to divert my acquisition activity. So the first thing I did was finishing pending work.
Ah, yes.
And then I started reaching out to clients about what we can do, just to use my situation as a as an opportunity. And funny things happened. And, I got a client who offered me a 2-year freelance contract. And then a few days ago, I got my contract for signing for a documentary in Somalia. So that one is on the rails. We have to sort out some small details. So on this beach, many things happened. And I'm doing a small film for a client. I'm talking with you. So somehow life continues from here. And
yeah,
it's quite interesting because if this continues, I could just stay on this beach.
Right. One of my favorite sort of philosophical questions is always, for life to happen, do you need to go out and take action? Many people say that, right? That's common motivational talk. On the other hand, what if you just stay home and do nothing? Does life still happen? Does life find you?
Yeah, maybe. It depends on your web. Like a spider has a web, and a spider sits in the middle and just waits. So it depends on the quality of your net, whether you have to move or not. Maybe that's a nice analogy to use.
Yes, yes.
If you have a good net, then you stay.
Hmm. Hey, you got me curious, especially because you mentioned Somalia. I mean, again, one of the things that occasionally goes under the radar or makes it above the radar these days is the stories from places where there's other major problems, and there have been, but they get unheard, especially because of corona stories coming to the top. When I think about Somalia, I think about all kinds of issues that the country or the region is dealing with. Have you worked in Somalia before? I don't remember this, Ruud.
Yeah, no, since 2005.
Yeah.
I went to 2005 for the first time. And since then, I've been going every other year, and I have to say the situation is improving, but the insecurity is still very high. And what we can see now, I'm monitoring it, is that Al-Shabaab is stronger than ever. It's like they're using the coronavirus as a shield to operate behind. There are more attacks. There are more attacks, and even big ones. But yeah.
How do they do that? I mean, how do they use the coronavirus as a shield?
Yeah, I think that they see that the structures have weakened. The military also has to deal with corona. That has consequences, and that it's like they're using that opportunity to make some statements. They're attacking badly, even places where people live. And yeah, that's at least interesting. It's also very sad, but on the other hand, I was reading that also Al-Shabaab got attacked by the coronavirus because they were first saying that the true Muslim would be immune.
Oh. No. So it works both ways.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay, but that's interesting, actually, that you say it is improving. I mean, I've also known it as a place where different regions are doing differently, basically, Mogadishu being its own thing, Somaliland and so forth. But it is interesting to hear from places that right now you simply wouldn't see it in any major publication on all the big news sources. It seems to get glossed over. It always has that risk on regular times, but now in pandemic times, really falls to the bottom of the list.
Yeah, exactly. It's the same with the locust.
Yes.
Just before the coronavirus, there was a huge locust plague, and they miraculously seem to have disappeared, all of them.
So where are they now? I remember in February they said they were in approaching Uganda, and the Ugandans were talking about it, but that's the last time I heard about it.
Yeah, exactly. It's like they simply don't exist anymore, but that's amazing. So I have to do some research there where they went.
Right. So that's that whole question of, what do they call it? Not food chain, but supply chain.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And you know quite a lot about supply chains, I think, because I've, over the years with the videos about different projects to build trains, to improve shipping routes. So that's always an interesting topic and a changing topic.
Nice, yeah.
Yeah. You've also, over the last few years, I think you've written definitely that you're open to projects that go beyond the continent. I mean, tell me about that a little bit. Like, I always find you're busy enough on the continent of Africa. What was the thinking behind going other places, and how did that go?
To learn. Mm. It doesn't happen so much. The last time I went to Australia some months ago. That was an interesting experience to see other societies, how they're dealing with their issues, and it's much more luxurious. But on the other hand, it's not so much different. It's also people striving for survival, but they have better means for it, and they have better backup systems. But yeah, once you see there's a pandemic, that they appear to be just as vulnerable as the African countries I'm traveling through. And if you look at the numbers, they're even much more vulnerable. And yes, that's what I get to tell Africans who have a kind of, okay, yes, now it's the turn to Europe. They should not complain because we always have these issues. But that's not really fair, because if a crisis hits Europe, it's much bigger. The numbers are much higher than any pandemic or epidemic they had on the whole continent. So yeah, that's not really fair to say those things, but still, it also makes them think that nobody is guarded against anything. So right, there might be a learning experience there as well.
Yes. Yeah. This idea, and we know it comes very loudly from the American government these days, but it's existed in quieter forms all over Europe, the idea that, oh, illnesses, wars, all the bad things, that's over there. And over there has taken the form of, sometimes it's an Africa thing, sometimes, I think, especially with Corona in the early times, it was thought, ooh, there's some kind of new disease in China. That's a China thing, though. We're going to be fine, because that doesn't happen here.
That's how it spread.
Yes. Yeah, I think there was a moment where the... And some people put this on the minister, the former minister of health here in the Netherlands, who wasn't doing very well physically when Corona broke out. And he had at least been part of the decision to send medical assistance to China during the Corona outbreak.
Yeah, yeah.
And then there was an attempt at criticizing him here because we needed some materials that perhaps we had sent. But you know, this kind of thinking, I mean, what does that mean? Then you should never engage with the rest of the world because you might have problems later?
Yeah, exactly. And for communities here, it's also interesting to see that Europe, where many people pay high prices to pay a boat to cross the Mediterranean, that also Europe is vulnerable. So it might be a lesson here as well. It's not the land of milk and honey. It's just another side of the world with its own challenges. So for both ways, it's a learning experience.
Yeah. But that's, you know, and that comes back to what I'm curious about, and we're going to see no matter what. But I've sort of wished, sometimes I wish for the story of this world and learning and improving to move faster, because I wish that people would learn or see some of these, what I consider to be truths. But I sometimes wonder if this passes quickly, will any lessons really be learned? But we don't, you know, we don't know. I bring it up because I'm hopeful.
Yeah. I hope that a better health response system will be there. Maybe permanent temperature testing or something small with a big effect.
Yeah. And let's see. I mean, it's possible. I know it's a big subject in the United States, but it's the idea of how your country uses their resources, whether it's money or whatever else, for a health system. And of course, all over the world, we have these private health systems and this idea of, well, you have to arrange your own insurance or whatever it is. But at times like this, I think we see the limitations of such a idea.
Exactly. Yeah. But what are you going to do? Because the previous pandemic is 100 years ago. So are you going to put a huge expensive system for something that happens once in a century? So it's, yeah, there are challenges that I have to look into. Like, how do we do that? Because it can happen again, but when and how big will it then be? You know, it's interesting. So I don't think they're going to do so much. Maybe a small early warning system. They have the institutions ready to scale up their response, something like that. But I don't see a big changes. It's because why? You know, it's highly unlikely that a thing at this scale is going to happen anytime soon. But yeah, it's possible. So yeah. Difficult to make an estimation on that.
Yeah. Well, what I see here is that it's also a reminder that as much as people love to be in their homes and focus on their family, their job, which is, I think, a global thing, it matters how your neighbors are doing and what's going on around you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I agree.
Yeah. Well, Ruud, I want to make sure, so people can, for those that haven't seen your work, don't know of your work, I mean, there's a couple of ways to go. I'll share your link to your YouTube channel, to your website, above all.
Yeah, cool.
And it's a really great domain, videojournalist.nl. As you said, you registered it in the early days.
Cool. Yeah, pretty cool, yeah.
Yeah. So I'll put those links out because, especially at a time like this, I mean, if people want information, they want video reports from that region.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
I would be happy with that.
Yeah. By the way, do you hear a lot about that? Like, I'm sure you know some foreign correspondents that you occasionally cross paths with. Where are all the foreign correspondents right now?
Well, there are many who took repatriation flights to their home countries.
Yeah.
But there are a few left. There are a few left. Not everybody went home.
Mm.
And also for myself, I have to see what to do.
Okay.
Because if it really goes out of hand here, I don't know, because we also have xenophobia, because they think it's the white people who brought it here.
Wow, okay.
So also sometimes you get shouted at like, Corona, Corona, Corona.
Jesus.
And that, if that takes a serious form, I have to consider what to do. But for now, I'm okay here.
Yeah.
And also, I would like to see it through here. And that's how I go. So I'm on the beach doing my business. And once I'll be able to move, I'll do more here.
Yeah. All right. Well, I look forward to it. And I hopefully the only name they call you in the near future is Muzungu. And
yes, exactly.
And we can go away with not being called Corona. I don't like that as much. All right. Well, Ruud Elmendorp, it's a pleasure to get to speak with you. And I would love to do it more often. I'll be in touch as always. But wish you all the best there in Tanzania. And thank you.
Thank you, too. And stay safe.
Yeah, we'll do. Ruud Elmendorp is a East Africa-based video journalist Find him at videojournalist.nl. And that does it for today's program. Big thank you to Ruud for checking in with us and giving us his time. And wherever you are out there in the world, I hope you're doing well. It has been some months now as we've been living in this pandemic, and I'm happy to have had this opportunity to speak with friends all over the world. I hope you've caught some of these programs, and I wonder if you haven't gotten something out of them. I've heard from some of you on the social media, via email as well. So thanks for all that. And by all means, as always with podcasts, there are more shows either coming up or if you go backwards in the archive. Either way, I appreciate that you're out there listening, and I will carry on with learning, asking questions, looking around at what is going on in the world. So thanks, and see you soon. See ya.